Welcome to the CG Pro Podcast. This is episode 53, and today we have with us Pedro D'Agostar. Welcome, Pedro.
But yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Thank you.
You bet. Great to have you on. So, yeah, Pedro is the head of 3D at Vine FX over in the UK. Yeah, if you enjoy today's episode, feel free to follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. But Pedro, great to have you here. Always love to start these just asking you a little bit about your background. How did you get into computer graphics in the first place? How did you get into film? Were there any kind of early inspirations from when you were a kid? Is it something you always wanted to do? Something you kind of found yourself in?
It's a bit. I guess slightly different. Often when I hear these stories, it always starts with, oh, I saw Star Wars, I saw Jurassic Park, and I wanted to do it. And that didn't really happen with me. I love those movies. Well, especially Jurassic Park, I think, is one of those classics which just doesn't age. And, you know, visually, it's just amazing. But I guess, yeah, it was a sort of a strange start. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think that's quite common for a lot of people leaving school and things. They don't know what they want to do. It's too young to decide. I knew what kind of things I liked. I knew I liked things with computers. I liked animation. I liked technical things. Quite a techie person. Gadgets and things are all pretty my thing. And I went to college and I did fine art just because I didn't know what else to do. And I was kind of rubbish at it, and it was a rubbish course as well. But luckily, I had sort of a bit of a gift from someone that their course that they were studying in computer games, they had a free space, and because I knew him, I was allowed to go onto the course. So it wasn't sort of open up for everyone. So I was really lucky to get that place, and I switched to that course. And I discovered 3D. I sort of was the first time using a 3D application, like 3ds Max we started with. And it was just great to sort of try all of the different things you could do in 3D, at least on a beginner's level. And then when that finished, I had to decide what I wanted to do at university. And I thought I wanted to do animation. So I applied to all these universities saying, you know, can I do animation and things? But they all turned me down because I couldn't draw very well. And animation to me was Pixar movies and things. It wasn't necessarily drawn stuff. So their courses, I guess, are quite broad, and you had to be a good drawer, and I was not. But luckily, someone on one of the interviews for the courses said, you might be interested in VFX. And I had no idea what that was. I literally didn't know what that could be. Until I had the chat and they said, yeah, you can join the course. And I looked at some of the students' work and I was kind of like amazed at what they were doing and seeing, you know, CG elements being integrated into plates and things. And it was just an eye opener, really. And I think the first time I really was, it's a strange one to be thinking about, like what the first piece was that sort of took me by surprise, and what I really liked and what I latched onto in the VFX world wasn't a big movie. It was actually a commercial. It was a really simple one. It was, I think it was the Channel 4 iDent, where it was,
oh yeah,
I think it was like bales of hay caught on fire, and yeah, it was in the shape of Channel 4. And I was like, that's so cool. I love that. Like, it just looks so real, but it's obviously not. And so that was like the first thing which really got me excited about getting a job in VFX. And so it was, yeah, slightly different, I think.
That's really cool. I remember that iDent. They really inspired me as well. And seeing, I remember that kind of gag that was like the camera was going past and they tracked it in, and then at some point,
yeah,
the set would resolve into the four and then it would go again. And like, there was like driving down a highway, there was one like that where all the bridges lined up, and
yeah,
really, really clever. I remember, yeah, I think that probably inspired quite a few, probably more people than you think. Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, well, the great thing was that when my second job, when I joined MPC, the head of 3D there was actually one of the guys who worked on them, so I was like, this is great.
Cool.
Kind of it all worked out quite nicely. Yeah,
Wow, yeah, that's cool. They were yeah, they were really great little pieces. I remember being totally inspired by them. Yeah, I think it's amazing what you can do. I've always said that CG is why I love it is because you can your imagination is the limit, really. I mean, sometimes the budget can get in the way, but
Yeah, it does a bit, yeah.
yeah, very cool. So you did some study and you jumped into what was the bit like between studying and getting to MPC? How did you get your first big break, if you like?
Well, I guess the first job I had was actually in Winchester, a place called Bandito. That was my first job, and I almost didn't even apply to it. It was my girlfriend who was like, "Just apply. It's a job. Do it." I was like, "All right, fine," and I got the job. So I was like, "Great." And so I moved down to Winchester, got my first job, and it was really good because I wasn't going into the running side of it. I was going straight into TV. Actually, as a compositor, it wasn't even in 3D at that point. Again, because I still hadn't really, even through university, found my absolute favorite thing. I really enjoyed so many aspects of it, of visual effects. So I started off as a compositor in After Effects for some TV shows. But they knew that I had abilities in 3D, and I think it sort of, there was some work there, and I was like, I can do that. So I started doing some CGI airplanes or military things that we were doing. So I would light those and even composite them. And I kind of started to latch onto the 3D side a bit more on that point. And I sort of wanted to step away from the comp side. I was quite happy doing it, but the 3D kind of caught my attention a lot more, and maybe I thought I was probably a bit better at it as well. So I think that was at the point at which I sort of decided I wanted to commit to 3D.
Got it.
Especially lighting, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, and you stayed there for a while, and then progressed on to MPC at some point.
Yes, yeah, I was there for a good 3 years, roughly, doing all manner of shows. We did a little movie as well. It was like an in-house sort of movie that was developed by the guy who was running the company at Bandito. So that was a really cool project as well, and it was massive. There was hundreds of shots and a tiny team of like 10 people. So off the back of that, the work looked really, really good, and that's when I managed to apply to MPC. And they took me on, yeah, as a lighter slash generalist, straight into a Super Bowl commercial with it was the Batman versus Superman Turkish Airlines collaboration,
Cool.
which was really cool. It was like a crazy, crazy step, basically. Really cool.
So move to London.
Yeah, I never lived in London, actually. I always commuted, and I was living in Hampshire, so close to where Winchester was. And I'd just commute, and it would be like an hour and a half door to door into work, because we were in every day at that point. I'm obviously working from home today. So yeah, it was a commute. I never lived in London. I never really had a desire to work in London. Sorry, live in London. Work in London was good, but I prefer to be outside.
Yeah, London's definitely I don't know, busy, I
Yeah.
would say. Exciting, but
Yeah.
busy.
Yeah, not for me, but I know that there are plenty of people who wouldn't leave it for anything. So each to their own.
Yeah, no, it's a great place, full of culture, all sorts of things going on. But yeah, lots of people, very busy. What so you were on Water Street?
That's right. Yeah, Wardour Street, place to be, and it was surrounded by pubs and nice places to eat and great coffee and things. And yeah, it was quite a nice. Quite a nice environment, actually. I enjoyed working there.
Cool
A
place
huge
to be.
variety as well. Yeah, and it was in the commercial side, so it wasn't on the movies. It was all commercials. We did one movie whilst we were there. We had like a chunk of the Ghost in the Shell movie, and which was pretty a unique experience, really, because after how you see commercials works, it's all quite small teams of not very specialized people. They're all quite generalist most of the time. Very experienced, really clever bunch of people that you get to work with. And to get this whole chunk of a movie spread between a room full of, literally a room full of 10 people, and, you know, absolutely smash it. It was so good. And, you know, the director, Rupert Sanders, he, I think it's him, he loved our work. He was really grateful for what we did and what we achieved. And it was really nice to see that you can do a movie with a small batch of people. Obviously, we didn't do all of the movie. It was a few sections, but it was, yeah, it was a really nice, really good experience.
That's cool. It can be done.
Can be done.
It doesn't have to all be split out into tiny little disciplines. It can be done.
No, exactly. Yeah. If you get the right team, I think it goes to show that maybe, I mean, I've never worked in a movie department in a bigger company, but knowing that there's so many levels to it, there's so many departments involved, you know, hundreds of people, maybe it's, you know, it can be done with a smaller team if you manage it correctly. And I think we did a good job.
That's cool. Yeah, I think it's typical that it's done in big situations where you've got lots of people, I guess, or big budget movies or whatever, that they split it out into disciplines. And it's still, I know that it's still somewhat like that, but some people are adopting smaller teams. I know Dean Egger have always been somewhat fond of doing that when it suits. I've worked at ILM being part of one very specific department before. You could tell it was very broken out, but yeah, it's cool working in a small team, getting to know people, and there's some kind of magic.
Yeah, I like it. It's a good collaboration. Everyone has a bit more of a voice, and it's definitely my preference is smaller teams.
I worked in, when I was in London, I worked at a place called Golden Square, which was in Golden Square, around the corner from there. But that was my stomping ground for years in London. And actually met Jackie in the ship on Wardour Street.
So, yeah, no way.
On the other side of the road. Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah, it's like an extension of MPC.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A few pubs, always the same place.
Yep. Yeah, I kind of miss that. And we're talking about I live in LA and missing London. I definitely miss being able to walk around. That's not something that you can really do in LA. You have to drive everywhere. But
oh, right, yeah.
London's kind of special, and I do miss it. But tell me what happened next. So you're at MPC, being a lighter.
Yeah. So I was exactly, lighting and commercials primarily. As it progressed, I started to lead some of the jobs, some of the commercials that came in, which was great. So I started to find, that I could do that. For a start, I was able to lead jobs. And I think one of the first jobs I led was just so smooth, and it was great. And I was really, really happy with how it went, and the result was great, and everyone on the team was happy, and it was a really good feeling. So I wanted to do more of that. I think I'm someone who's definitely driven by progression. I do like to just keep climbing the ladder. Lots of people don't. They prefer to just do the creative things. I like to sit and, you know, actually make the pixels. I think I like to help people make the pixels. Right. For me. And it progressed into quite a few jobs led, and even one or two jobs supervising on set as well, which was great. It was a whole different take on things, you know. Going out there, seeing how it was shot was really interesting, the first time especially, not knowing who to talk to or who you shouldn't talk to and everything. It's kind of crazy. When to talk to people and everything. So that was really good. And I wanted to keep going in that regard. And then things sort of started to change a bit at home. So my partner, she got a job up in Cambridgeshire. So we were moving from Hampshire to Cambridgeshire. I was still commuting to London, but it was at this point that I started to get in touch with Michael, who's the head of, or the owner of Vine FX, where I am now. And we just said hello and sort of said, yeah, nothing at the moment, but we'll keep in touch. And it went quiet for a good year or so. And I was commuting, and it was taking me 2 hours door to door to get to work and back, which was just exhausting a bit, from Cambridge all the way into London. And I think I was 3 years at MPC when I started to think about going maybe somewhere else. And I had child on the way, so my partner and I were having a kid, which was cool. And I had to sort of decide what I want to do. Did I want to stay commuting 2 hours a day in London, or did I want to try and find something local? And luckily, it was like almost perfect timing that Michael from Vine was like, "Hey, we've got an opening. Are you interested?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great." And yeah, so timing was just absolutely perfect with how it all worked out. And decided to make the step to leave London, work in Cambridge, which is where Vine is, and make my commute from 2 hours door to door to 20 minutes door to door, which was great.
Much better.
So yeah, definitely.
I know those two-hour commutes. I've had them even in LA. Actually, I have the 3 hours, I think, was the worst one I had here. It definitely takes a huge chunk out of your life.
It
So
does, yeah.
now, what's it like now? I know everybody has gone through everybody having to work from home. You guys still working from home mostly? You going in a mix of
We
the
well,
two?
I myself, I'm hybrid, so I will work 3 days in the office and 2 days out. So Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'll be at home, like today. Most of the production staff are in every day, so they're in the office every day, and then we've got a few compositors in every day. And then most other people are remote, so the majority of the artists are actually just remote full time.
Full
So,
time.
yeah. Because they're all over the world. They're actually, there's not that many in England, actually, I guess, on the team. So they're all in Bulgaria, Italy, Turkey, Norway, France, all over. So yeah, it's a very culturally diverse team, which is great.
That's cool. Yeah, diversity is important to us. We actually have a non-profit that's completely focused on diversity. Not coincidentally, but by the by.
Yeah.
So did that change because of COVID? Was it like that already?
Actually, yeah, no, not really. It was already the case that quite a few of the members, especially in the compositing team, I think, were already remote. We even had an animator who was in Australia, so that was quite a big time difference to deal with. But
Just a
it
bit.
worked. He was great. So, we were already kind of set up in a way to be remote. So when the day came that it was like lockdown and everyone had to go home, we just picked up our Chiarodici box and a monitor and slung it under our arms, went home and set up desk. And within a day, pretty much the whole company was back online working again, which was quite phenomenal, really.
That's cool. So
And
was everything kind of set up to be remote effectively? Or
exactly,
were
yeah.
your
So
machines already like, were they in the office or in the cloud
they
or?
were in a machine room on site. So even in the office, we weren't connected. They weren't under our desks. They were still in the machine room. So it just made the switch a switch, quite literally. Yeah, it worked out really well. And we were lucky. We didn't get affected too heavily by the pandemic. So we already had jobs on which were going to go on for a while. So by the time we had finished doing all of those, production could start again and we were already moving on to the next job. So we were really lucky to get away with it and not to have too many sort of cuts, so to speak. Yeah, so we were quite lucky.
Oh, that's amazing. What did the pandemic cause any changes to what you did to
Well, I
make it
guess
make
ultimately now is I'm working hybrid, so that's something that's changed. Which is great because it means then I can be at home with my son. When I finish work, I'm already there. I can see him, put him to bed and everything, which is great. But I think, yeah, ultimately Vine itself was, as I say, it was ready for this kind of work. So I wouldn't say it made an enormous change. It just meant that a few more people were working remotely when some people already were working remotely.
Right.
it worked out well. I prefer it. I prefer being hybrid. I think for me it suits me. I know that some people go in the office every day because they want to. Other people are hybrid, and I know that some people would never want to step foot in an office. So it's each to their own, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think there's pros and cons to it, to both. I kind of like I'm mostly at home. But I kind of like going in a bit. I've worked from home going back, even back into my software engineering career. I did a lot of work from home, but I like to kind of a balance. And I think, what do you think about for younger people just getting into the industry?
Yeah, it's got to be tricky. I must say, with especially if you're a junior, you get so much experience from the people around you. So having to be remote in that time when everyone had to be remote must have been, really difficult for a lot of people just starting out. It must have been really tough. I think now that things are opening up a bit again, I would suggest that those juniors especially do get in the office to get the mentorship and everything that they can to help them progress, and to nothing beats just looking over someone's shoulder and seeing what they're doing. And it's so hard to do that when you are remote. You're sort of isolated from everyone. You might have some good methods of communication in there. They might do lots of chatting with Teams or Slack or whatever, and calls, Zoom calls and everything, but it's not quite the same as just being there with someone and learning and just catching mistakes before they're too late, or before someone spent so long on them, and then they go, "Hey, look at my work," and then you're like, "Oh, should have done this. If I was there,
It's
you, I would
upside
have told
down.
you that." Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, my advice would always be, if possible, to be in the office especially when you're starting out, I would say. If possible, I mean, it's not always possible, and I know that people cope, so.
Yeah, different way of doing it. I guess if you have the opportunity, I would do it as well. I think there's, especially in the beginning, as you said, whilst you're building your skill set, I wanted mentorship. My first job I had was in on Harry Potter, and then I ran into commercials because I wanted mentorship and variety, and I chose it specifically because of that. And I think it's important if you can get it. So, tell us a bit about Vine. What do you guys do? What kinds of work do you do?
We primarily do television, so well, pretty much all television work at the moment, ranging from well, recently we just delivered The Witcher season 3, so that was a big job for us. We I think made a quite a big step up in quality and everything when we did that job, and everyone enjoyed it. So it was a really good amount of work to come our way, and completely nail it as well. So that was a big one. But we do, yeah, all kinds of things. So we do things for the BBC, for Netflix, for ITV, Channel 4, any TV show really. Primarily, comp would be a big department. So we would have, obviously the cleanup things to come our way, but those of environments would be something that we specialize in, I would say. With the matte painting and integration with environments and things would be a big one for us. Creature work is something that we really like to do and develop ourselves in doing. So we've done a few jobs where we've had multiple creatures, animals and things, or in one case it was for War of the Worlds, we had robot creature, so that was completely different. It's a really big variety of work. It could be one job could be a CG bird, and the other job could be storms in the ocean, which is what we've also recently delivered as well. So, yeah, it's a really nice big variety of work that we've got in all kinds of TV, different budget levels and all sorts. So, we prefer the high budget, but can't always get them.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's good to get a mix of things. And I always felt like working on a range of budgets was good for your skill set as well,
Definitely.
making you more resourceful. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's completely right. And I really like the variety myself. not just in the work, but also in the limitations that you're given. So, having a small budget doesn't necessarily mean the work has to be rubbish. It doesn't have to look bad. We always do our very best to make it look as good as possible within the constraints. And you could also look at it like, okay, not much time, not much budget. Let's just rush it through and skip things which shouldn't be skipped. When really the way to do it is to cut the right corners to know to learn from what you've done when you had the budget and the time, and know what you can get away with and replicate it on a quicker level. That's quite a skill, to be honest, to be able to maximize efficiency. Ultimately, it comes down to efficiency, I think, in knowing what to cut, what corners you can cut without sacrificing quality, which I think Vine does exceptionally well.
That's great. Yeah.
Personally,
And
yeah.
so it helps with your resourcefulness and being able to work, do more with less, which I ultimately helps you when you are on those bigger shows, right? Like you can
Yeah.
draw from that well.
Exactly. Yeah. So now that you know which corners to cut when the bigger jobs come, you can choose to cut those again and still produce something that looks incredible, like we always aim to do. So yeah, it's a good tool almost to be able to know what to do in that regard, and it helped us a lot when we did The Witcher, which was a bigger budget show. We didn't skimp, to say that, that's for sure. We ploughed everything we could into it, and it's just nice to be able to look at any job that we do and be happy with the result. And whether the budget was big or small, we can look at it and go, this looks great. And I think that's it's pretty hard to do.
Speaking of tools, what I know the landscape is changing significantly out there. What kind of tools are you using and seeing being used the most these days?
Well, there's been a big push towards Houdini for the CG side in recent days. So primarily we were just Maya only, but I think you've got to keep with the trends and you've got to keep on progressing. And so we are trying to develop our Houdini side a bit more. I don't think we ever wanted to get rid of Maya, because there's still things which it can do better. And not only that, it's also the people. If the people are comfortable in the software and they can produce the pixels that look good, then why switch? So there's a bit of a balance, but we've got to progress, and Houdini is one that is going that way. So we're definitely moving in that direction.
For what kinds of things? So, and I'm hearing a lot of people out there using moving towards Houdini for lighting and like
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
replacing
I think
Cortana and.
for that, for sure. I think one of the jobs that we're doing now has an enormous environment, and I just sort of wish that we had done it in Houdini because it would have been so much easier. But I think it was just our pipeline was stronger at the time for Maya, and it made most sense to do it that way. But it's one of those where it just works a lot better for those kinds of situations and scenarios when you've got enormous assets. Lighting is great in there as well, like you say. And obviously the effects side with the simulations is just the only way to do it really at the moment, I think. There's not Maya has tools to do it, but they're not as good.
Yeah, Houdini's a beast. It can eat geometry for breakfast. It just doesn't complain.
Yeah. And then I guess other than that, I guess in the comp side, there's a lot of new tools coming out, maybe AI-based tools which are helping the artist get the shots out quicker or better. I don't see necessarily AI as taking over personally. I see it as a good tool, and I wouldn't let people worry about AI taking over jobs. I just can't see it happening yet. It's a tool, and all the stuff that we're seeing now, where Midjourney coming in and then Runway to make it move, and it looks kind of cool, but it's not the same. It doesn't have any soul. Doesn't do what people want it to really do. I think it just looks kind of cool. So people are at the moment, I guess, on the hype train of it, but really, it's not there yet, and there's nothing to to extract in to actually to change your workflow that much to use those tools. I don't think it's ready. It's the smaller tools which help with roto or with help with upscaling, that those kinds of tools, those are kind of useful.
The things which are annoying to do anyway.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, the less creative jobs, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. We were talking about that a lot last night and how it's affecting the industry. There's a lot of fear out there around, well, a lot of everything out there around AI at the moment, around the fear of people losing jobs or stealing other people's work, or and then on the plus side of it helping empower people and being able to do more with
Yeah.
less people, which is a great,
That's
especially in a small team, a really, really good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the way I see it going. Maybe one day, maybe like 10 years from now, it might change a little bit more. There's some more advancements, more ways of making it creative on a human level. But I know, no, it won't change that drastically. And there are tools which aren't creative, like we say, which help get through the jobs. Like Nerf's coming out now with some interesting results. They're extremely limited. They can't do much. They're sort of their own isolated thing. But there must be some scenario where it's going to be of use. I think probably can't say what it is at the moment, but we might be trying to use that. We're exploring it at the moment in a way that could be used in production. And I think it's just a really interesting tool, and that's all I see as a tool.
I think that's a great way to look at it. I think it's really good for people to hear that too, because of the fear aspect of it. I think there's a lot of people who are scared of it. Maybe people are looking to get into the industry and thinking, should I bother if all the jobs are going to be gone soon? I'm like, I think we've seen this before in history, and the future is unknown always. But I think it's really good to hear. I think, especially for people not in the industry, they may think that people it's already happened, that people are already just sitting there pressing a button and everyone's gone home and the work is just being done by itself, and it's just not the case.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, I think maybe there's probably some occasions where someone has managed to, I don't know, maybe scam a client into thinking that they've done some work which they haven't, for maybe some still images, for some concept, maybe. But it's never going to progress enough for that person to completely use that tool, like Midjourney, to do all of their concept work. That won't work. The director will ask for a change, and they can't do it
Can't do
because
it, then yeah, what do you do?
because the whole image changes. You can't. It doesn't work. So, yeah, don't see it.
So what would your advice be to anyone starting out in that sense, just in terms of what should you learn?
Well, I think you should make the most of the tools that you have. I wouldn't disregard them. I wouldn't say that some of the little tools that are in Nuke, for example, you should just ignore them because they're going to be of use. So you might as well maximize what is worthwhile and what is good. But ultimately, you just got to work on yourself and work on what you like and what you're good at. And I think the work will still be there. The work will come if the talent's in the people. It's not in the software. So I think, as long as you keep your head clear of that, and you just keep pushing forward, and learning what you're most interested in, whether that be in 3D or 2D or wherever, yeah, just keep going. I think learning the right software even isn't as critical as building up your own abilities. I think you can transition software quite easily. Once you know what you want to do, it's just got to find the right button to do it. And so if you want to start in Blender, then start in Blender. It's a great way in. It's free. There's loads of resources, loads of material to learn. There aren't many actual studios that use Blender, but you could easily transfer those skills into Maya or Houdini, and progress your
So
career that way. Yeah.
learning the fundamentals that are
Exactly.
common to
Yeah.
all the software, and then sometimes it's been my experience too. I had to learn something in a day and start doing shots in it the same day. You do have to sometimes do that and be jump that quickly. But no, having a good foundational knowledge, which the, I think, again, looping in AI into that conversation, like you said, if you want to change something that was prompt generated and you don't have the ability to get in there and make that change, then, and you want to have those fundamentals to fall back on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're going to get stuck pretty quick and found out. Yeah. And yeah, even with the tools that you that are of use, I think it's still probably worthwhile before AI took over them. You know, with the roto side, if you're a compositor, you still want to learn how to do roto, because it's, you know, that tool might not always be available, or you know, I think it's important to understand all the levels, and you know, maximize your skill set so that you can be in any situation and still come out with a good result.
With so you mentioned Blender. Are you seeing, I know I ask this question to a lot of people these days, are you seeing people picking it up a bit more in the industry? I know it was Maya and nothing else for the longest time, but.
Yeah, I think there are a few studios that are actually using it in production. We have it. We don't really use it. We don't have a big pipeline for it. And a lot of the 3D artists that work for us know how to use it too. And they use it sometimes kind of as a tool to do certain things, and they know they can get it done quicker in Blender because that's where they're most comfortable. Then they just port it into Maya or Houdini so that it's in the pipeline and can be worked on further. I guess the great thing is that it doesn't require a license, so anyone can just install it and do whatever they need to do and then port it over to wherever it should be. It's a great tool, definitely. And I'm seeing more and more people applying to Vine, and even, you know, on Reddit, you go on the VFX of Reddit and you see people talking about Blender and using Blender a lot, and there's nothing wrong with it, really. It's good.
Yeah, started to get really good after 2.8, and before that was just so many things that were not professional enough, but now it's a great tool. It's great to hear that. Especially it being a way to learn and then being able to progress from there. And I think, a lot of people are curious about what they should learn. When I started, it was just Maya, learn Maya. That's what you need to do. And that's what I did. And at this point, it's interesting to hear that the tools are changing and people are able to use different tools. So Houdini, Nuke, Blender, but still Maya, a lot of Maya.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we're at, basically.
Any Unreal Engine?
To test the nerfs, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's something that you always see on LinkedIn. You see these really cool demos of this new thing in Unreal. And it always looks so exciting and it always looks so good. And then you start to dive into it. I think it's probably not quite ready for production in some cases. It's not taking over yet. I don't see it as something that's going to take over yet. I think it could do. And it's really nice that the real-time side of things is picking up to be more photorealistic. It's definitely exciting and going to be really good to have that kind of interactivity in the future. It's good. It's got its uses for sure. But for the final output, I think it's not probably quite there yet. Not necessarily just in the quality either. It could also be the interface of it, what you can do to actually produce the result that you want to produce. It could be something like that rather than, because it might look great, but you might not be able to sculpt it how you want to sculpt it.
Yeah.
I think it's gonna be big when it takes the extra step. I guess at the moment they're not really focused primarily on visual effects, they're focusing on games. So maybe if someone starts to develop the VFX side of it, maybe it will become even more useful, more potent.
And the nerf thing's really, really interesting as well. We actually had a a session in our inner circle at TG Pro last night about nerfs, and had somebody come in and talk about them and do some demonstrations of them, and seeing like some things I didn't know, like it's actually built into Google Maps now. You can, there's an immersive mode where you can look at
really?
Some things in Nerf, and
that's a perfect use for it. Street View would be great in as a Nerf. That's like so cool. Yeah,
being able to go into buildings, like inside buildings in Google Maps now, and stuff like that's really amazing. How we can explore our world, and seeing it on an LED wall as a background as opposed to a video plate. You know, the photographic component is as you mentioned, in a photorealism is what you're usually striving for in visual effects.
Yeah,
and one of my first mentors said that. When I asked him, how do you achieve photorealism? He said, use photos, use photographs in every place that you can. And now we're seeing more of that, I guess, with photogrammetry and actual photo modeling, as well as Nerfs, which aren't a model. They're kind of a weird thing. I think a lot of people don't really know what they actually are. But seeing the place where they can be implemented, being able to use them, even being able to do things with them, like we saw how you can actually edit them. You can actually change, even though they aren't 3D stuff, they're not voxels or polygons. They're just a neural net. But it's a strange thing to kind of think about as a 3D artist, because you're always trying to manipulate some stuff, and with Nerfs there is no stuff to manipulate.
But I guess with progression, you know, the more they develop it, the more these things, you know, the better they get, the more you can do with them. You might be able to start extracting things, you might be able to just generate materials for things. You know, I can see that happening. You photo scan or Nerf a table, surely at some point it's going to be a click of a button and it's going to produce a clean topology table with a shader already set up with all the right textures. And you can kind of see that happening with Nerfs eventually. Not there yet, but I can see that being a perfect use case.
Yeah, and starting to look into moving Nerfs, and at this point already you can edit them. You can have seen some ways to be able to add and subtract and even crudely relight. But so
it's pretty cool.
Interesting new kind of like context that's not one that we're used to.
Yes.
Figuring out all the things that we want to do with it, like being able to create it, to edit it, to display it. We've got a couple of questions here. So one person is saying, a few of us are learning VFX modeling. We've got big ideas and hopes and dreams. When you're looking at portfolios, what are the things you enjoy seeing? What turns you off? And has anyone's work sample surprised you? It's a good question.
They always surprise me. I think there's always something in there which is interesting. I think the things that I don't like are when the showreel is too long or repetitive. If you've shown that you can do something, then move on and show me something else. I think is, you know, recruiters, and I'm not a recruiter, but I look at the reels and I've got a short attention span, I'm busy. So when I'm looking, I want to be grabbed immediately with something that's good. And you can show some good work, but then if you keep showing it over and over, and there's just in this environment, in that environment, it's like, okay, I get it, move on. I want to see something else. I want to see what else you can do. So, I think keeping it short and sweet, and the quality rather than the quantity is the number one, is the one thing that they need to focus on. In terms of being surprised, I think I'm often surprised with the amazing work that people are producing from either hobbyist or junior levels now. You know, when I released my first showreel from university, I look back at it now and I'm like, this is awful. Like, I wouldn't hire me. comparing it to what some people are producing now straight from their universities or even just like self-taught, it's incredible the step up. And I don't know if that's just because more people are interested in it and there's a broader spectrum of people doing it, or if because the tools are much better Maybe that's why the quality is better as well. Or a mixture of both, I would guess. But yeah, I'm always kind of surprised at the level of quality that people are producing now from young ages. Even some people who are like, I want some work experience. I'm 12 years old or 14 years old, and they show us their work, and it's like really amazing, really impressive. They can't get a job yet, and they're still learning, but you can tell that they're going to go a long way because of what they've produced is just so amazing for their age. I don't know how they would have done that.
Yeah, I guess being exposed to the right tools, people at the right time. Somebody else is asking, how can we grow our career from VFX compositor to VFX supervisor?
You've just got to work your way through all the steps. I think I probably made a mistake of wanting to be a supervisor too soon. I remember in my first job at Bandito in Winchester, I knew I wanted to do that. I knew I was driven by progression, like I've said, and I was getting frustrated that I wasn't already leading things or I wasn't making these decisions. And it's a good job I didn't because I was still so junior. It's kind of silly. So the best way is to just take your time with it. It will come, especially if you're driven to that as your goal. You've got to understand all the steps. You've got to understand not just what you're good at, but what everyone else is good at, and all the levels involved with all the departments. That's the best way. To really be a good supervisor and progress in that way. If you just obviously you've got to be good at your craft and you've got to hone in your skills to level up those steps, but I think you've got to make sure that you take your time with them and don't just go from 0 to 100 and rush in because you'll probably make mistakes and cause issues for the team with poor decision making or just lack of experience. Experience is so important. Being in all those different scenarios as an artist rather than a supervisor, you know what you can learn so much. And I think that's really important to do it that way and not rush into it.
Right. I'm spending time in the trenches actually doing the work and being around the work is tricky with the VFX soup because you won't necessarily have done all the things that you're supervising as a VFX soup directly.
No, but it's good to have an understanding of them, I think. Yeah, you can't understand all the levels of how to be a great effects artist when you've been a lighter or something, and then you progress to be a supervisor. You can't know everything, but I think you've got to have an understanding of the fundamentals of all of the departments that you're going to be interacting with, and departments that are going to be interacting with your work afterwards.
Yeah, makes sense. We have another question here saying someone saying any favorite sites or resources for learning Houdini?
Well, there's obviously YouTube, which is great because there's loads of free stuff on there. I have a friend of mine, I don't know if he's listening, who runs Houdini-course.com. You can give me some money for that, Christian, if you're listening. It's actually a very good course. I actually took some of the courses myself so that I could be more proficient in helping people, or just understanding and supervising in that regard. But yeah, I guess YouTube is a great place to start just to get the basics, the fundamentals, and Reddit, talking to people and seeing what they suggest, who deep dive into Houdini themselves. Because on an artist level, I've never really fully deep dived into Houdini. I've done shots, I've lit things, I've set things up, but I've never really deep dived into it because that was sort of later into my career when it started to really kick off. Wish I had done. But yeah, the resources are out there for me to just have a look whenever I need to brush up on something. I can definitely learn what I need to learn or at least understand the concepts of it.
That's the tricky part with Houdini, right? Is understanding how it thinks, because it thinks differently than other 3D programs.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
once you're over that hurdle, you kind of understand its language. But until that point, it's you're expecting, like, where's the outliner? Where are all my things? What is this? It's like a soup of stuff that you kind of inject ingredients to and inject instructions into, rather than, it's more of a programming aspect
Yeah,
to,
exactly.
even though you, yeah,
If you can
go ahead.
abstract that side of it, if you know how to program inside it, you can unleash a whole nother beast of Houdini itself. But I guess it's not critical to do that. I don't think it's vital that everyone knows how to program or anything. And
No.
thankfully, it's progressed in a way that you don't need to. I think in earlier versions, it was a lot more important to have that understanding of programming, perhaps different codes and things, languages, sorry. But now it's become more sort of artist friendly, which means that more people, and I think that's where the big push has come from, is that it's now more artist friendly, that people can just dive in. They know what they want to create, they've just got to find out what buttons to push.
Right. Yeah, it's getting that way more and more. Still a bit of a beast for sure. And I think I think it does help knowing a little bit of programming still, just because with any proceduralism, I think, whether it's in Houdini or Blender or even Unreal Engine now has its PCG, its version of proceduralism. But understanding logic, I think, helps in all computer graphics. Because you if you know how what's actually going on under the hood with anything, then it empowers you even in the artist tools at the top. Somebody saying, as it's such a big program, what part of Houdini do you recommend people learn?
Well, I think, well, first of all, the basics to understand the interface. That's number one. And then beyond that, it's really what you want to develop, what you want to go into. Do you want to be an effects artist? Do you want to be a rigger? Do you want to be a lighter and all these other various areas that you could be going into? I wouldn't say everyone should just do this thing first because there's so many avenues you can go down. So you've just got to find out what your avenue is, what you want to do, and then explore it in that way. It's not really a question which you can have give a defined answer to. I don't think it depends. And then you just find the resources online by asking questions, going on Reddit, going on YouTube to find the resource you want, or to universities, colleges and things. Plenty of courses online to help.
Any favorite projects of yours that you've worked on?
I'd say there's two projects which really, maybe three, really stood out. Three which stood out. I'll go in age order. So the first one was at my first company, Bandito, which was the movie. It was called Kill Command. It was such a huge project, a huge undertaking for us to take on. It was 10 artists doing 1,000 shots, and I think 500 of them had CGI elements in. And I think I lit 350 of them, and
Wow.
it was a huge task. And actually, it looks really quite good, like considering all things considered, with the budget and the time and the team. And it was still, I was only like 2 years experience at that point. That was always something which would probably appear in my showreel, even in 5, 10 years from now, just because it holds up. So that would be the first one, and then the second one would be Ghost in the Shell at MPC. That was such a cool experience, going from the commercial to the movie, but still with the same team. And then seeing it on the big screen and knowing it was seen by all, or not all, by all, but a lot of people saw it. People see commercials, but they don't think twice about them most of the time. So to get the sort of, I don't know, bragging rights of a big movie was quite fun. And the sequences that we had quite a bit of creative input on what they should look like. And it was one of the things was so simple. There was It's in this red interrogation room type environment, just a box room with basically a red sticker on the floor of these white lines. And they're analyzing these dead bodies, which are just virtual holograms and things. And the client didn't like the floor. It looked like a sticker. So we had to think of a way to make it look better, more advanced in technology. And I had basically projected that sticker and then turned it into like a glass frosted floor and projected those white lines and dots straight down. So it looked like a hollow void underneath them, and it just fit the mood perfectly. And I was really pleased that I had done that and I'd
Came
figured
up with
out
it.
what it should look like. And you remember it? Okay.
Yeah. It's not that often that you get to do something. You usually get a shot at the end of its life, and so this is the concept art, just make it like that. But yeah, it's really cool that you got to have that experience of adding
Yeah,
your own flavor to it.
exactly. Yeah, and it was really good collaboration with the team. They were all really, really talented people, and producing some amazing graphics for it, and the hologram effects were just incredible. And it was a really good experience. And knowing that the director was so happy with our work, knowing that it was such a small team, made the difference too. And I think he also gave me probably the best bit of advice. Rupert Sanders was when given feedback, would often, if they said, "Oh, make it brighter," or "make it faster," people would just do a like tiny bit more because they don't feel confident in what they're doing. And he'd get so annoyed with people just doing these micro incremental changes. He would just say, in a very elaborate way, he described it, but essentially he said, "Go too far, and then we can talk about reining it in." And since we did that, iterations went so much quicker because we were finding the extremes and then going to the balance in the middle. And sometimes they liked the extreme, sometimes they liked nowhere near the extreme. And it was so much quicker to find what the final result was by going too far and then reining it in afterwards. And that's something that I've followed ever since. I think it was just great, great advice. So to everyone listening, great advice.
That's
Go
cool.
too
Yeah,
far.
I think that was one of the things that was really challenging for me in the beginning, coming from programming, not doing making imagery, was taking visual notes and then saying, okay, no, 10% less, or not even with the number, just make it a bit less saturated or a bit brighter or a bit faster. And I found it went both ways. Like you'd either say, like you said, make it a bit faster, and they would just make it a teeny bit faster, or you'd make it really, really fast. And then let's say that I was learning about that idea of like 1% opacity change and being able to detect it visually and knowing when. That's, I think, where essentially what you're saying is a communication is so important in, and describing visual things is quite challenging sometimes.
And then 9 times out of 10, the answer in the end would be split the difference. So
Yeah, right. That's why
but you get
go
the
too far is good, because
yeah.
you're not like seeing the change really, and you're like getting
No,
to test it,
can't
stress
see it.
testing it. It's like an engineering principle really, of like stress testing the visuals.
It's a really good way of progressing quicker. So that was good. And then the final, I guess, final standout was at Vine, we did The Tourist, which was aired on the BBC. And it was the first time at Vine we did multiple animals, CG animals, in one show. So we'd done a few odds here and there. And this was, this time we had really gone further and we'd done multiple. We did a couple of tortoises, we did a kangaroo, we did a boar, a wild boar. And we really tried to make them all look as good as they could possibly be within the constraints and everything. And they hold up really well, and especially the tortoises. I think they look great. The act that they're performing is interesting, but it's a really good piece of work, which not only did we enjoy making, but then when it was aired on TV, it was like the most watched TV program of the year. Not including streaming services, but on normal TV, it was the most watched TV program, and it was really well received. Everyone really liked it, and I guess that just felt quite special that to produce some really nice work that lots of people saw was, it's just a nice feeling.
That's great.
And a step up as well for Vine itself. So it was good.
Good all round.
Yeah.
Very cool. So a couple more questions. Now we're getting towards time here, but someone asking, how do you ensure the quality of VFX shots meets the standards of the project?
Well, I think that's probably the best thing about TV versus movies is that you get way less of that. I don't know what the correct term is without swearing. pixel analyzing.
Effing. Yeah.
Yes. There's way less of that. So, yeah, there's much less of that. So it becomes a case of we look at it on a big TV and we go, does it look good? Or are we seeing issues? And if we can't see any issues, then it's good and it goes. We don't have to zoom in and, you know, just is this patch of pixels doing what it should be doing? As long as we look at it on a broad scale and go, this looks great, then we're happy, then, and the client's going to be happy too. There might be some cases where we do go in and zoom in and check that it's all fine and make sure the edges are good and there's no issues, but it's nowhere near on the same level as in movies, I think, or even really, really high-end commercials. It's a lot more forgiving, and the ultimate thing is it's going to be on screen for a second before it moves on to the next thing, and people just care about the storyline. They don't really care about the visuals as much. So as long as it looks good and you don't think about it, then your job is done. So then you can move on. So it's just got to not draw your eye. It's got to be seamless.
Right. Another question here. Does specialization these days mean you have to be a master of several trades like Unreal, Houdini, etc.? Which combination do you think is the most compelling for real-time filmmaking in the future? I guess that's two questions.
I don't think you have to be a master of everything. I think specialization still has its place, especially in movies. And it depends on what the areas are. I think, for example, animation is one which I think would always be a specialist thing. There are generalists that can animate and can animate quite well, but it's never a replacement for an animator. So it depends on, you know, what avenue you're going down, I guess. But if you're going into real-time film and things, yeah, Unreal Engine's going to be a big player. So you've got to have a big understanding of that. And I would say probably Houdini as well would be a big one. Just, I think they talk to each other quite nicely. So those are probably two big ones. And then, you know, if you're on set and you're doing mix and overlay type things, you might explore other applications as well. But yeah, I think having a good knowledge of those and having a basic understanding of Nuke is always really important for most CG artists, for like that produce renders. Having an understanding of Nuke just to put your images together is also quite a good skill to have. All of our lighters, for example, will be in Nuke at some point, putting their comps together on a really basic level. It wouldn't have to look like a final comp, but A over B, put the rotor in the right place, render it out. That's good enough.
Right. Even 3D artists should have some understanding of compositing, being able to do your own pre-comps at the very least. Sometimes you may even do the final, depending on the project, but the time frame, etc. One last one here. How do you think virtual production will grow in the future and make a big business? That's an interesting question. Any thoughts on virtual production, I guess?
We have used it on a couple of shows on some level. So I think on War of the Worlds season 3, we were inside the International Space Station. And outside the couple of windows was a big screen array, and pre-rendered the Earth on that. So it was already there for, we didn't have to chop out people in front of windows and replace green screen or anything. It was already there. It was great, and the lighting was right, was correct from the offset. So I think, I don't know, from my perspective of virtual production, having those big array of monitors, the primary use from it is the lighting that you get. You don't have to worry about having lighting a green screen for then to spill onto everything, and then that affects what the lighting is of your performance is as well. If you've got the background already looking like what it's meant to look like, you've just saved a bunch of time with integration. But then there's not only that, there's also the interactive virtual production where, you know, your camera's moving and the background's moving too. I think Chemical Brothers just released a new music video with huge virtual production set, and it looks incredible. If you haven't seen that, go watch it. It's amazing.
Yeah, I saw that the other day. It's really cool. I'm a
Especially, did you
Chemical Brothers
notice
fan.
the tumbleweed that went from being on set to then going into the virtual production? It's quite weird.
No, I'm going to go back and see it again.
Yeah, it's near
And
the
it was
beginning.
all
There's a tumbleweed. Yeah, crazy.
in one shot, or so it looks. Maybe it wasn't shot in one shot.
There's probably some clever breaks in there, I would imagine. But yeah, it's very cool, and it's only going to get better, and the quality is going to get better. The pixel density probably will get better, so we can get even closer to it. The interactivity, the brightness of everything will get better. It's going to be probably very big, especially for movies. You know, like we've seen Star Wars using it in their filming as well. I think it's definitely the only way is up for it.
Well, definitely I got something to say about that at the end, which I guess we are close to. Before we close, is there anything that you want to share with the audience? Anywhere they can follow you or your studio's work or anything that you want to share at all?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow the company and myself on LinkedIn. That's probably the best place I always go to for this kind of thing. So you can always add me and VineFX as well. Just give them a follow. They're always posting new reels and work that we've done. And yeah, keep an eye out for any openings, I guess, for jobs. And there's also the speculative applications as well. So we always like to look through every application, and yeah, so do apply.
That's great. Great advice too, I think, to anyone out there looking to break in the industry. Even if there isn't an opportunity, maybe there is an opportunity that just to
Yeah,
go for it.
and quite often it can be the case that something happens in production, you're like, okay, we need someone now. And you just look through who's applied recently, and this happens to be the right person, and you don't even need to put an advert out because you found the person who's just applied a week ago speculatively. So yeah, definitely worth doing.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Good
Nothing to lose.
advice. No, absolutely. I think that's the thing you feel, and I did, and still do around some things. You feel that fear of something bad's going to happen because we're biologically programmed to fear change. But really, like, that's an inappropriate response to something as simple as like posting a video on LinkedIn or sending a job application in. Like, there's nothing. There really, literally, is nothing to lose. And
No,
people
no.
sometimes think that it's, I shouldn't apply with this now. I need to wait until I'm this good to apply. But that it's fine to keep applying, right? Like, you can send something in if you
Update.
listen to the notes, get better.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can always, you know, if it's been a year since you last applied, just apply again, update everything, then you'll be nearer the top of the list. Yeah, it always helps. So.
Some great advice. Well, Pedro, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time, and it's been great chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been really, really cool. And thanks for the questions, everyone who's posted them. Some really good ones. And yeah, you can always message me on LinkedIn if you have any more.
Right. Well, yeah, you should all do that for sure. Thank you, everybody, today for joining us, for asking great questions and participating, making this another great podcast. This has been episode 53. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can expect another episode in 2 weeks. You can follow us in our Facebook group or at becomecgpro.com. And speaking of Star Wars and virtual production, CG Pro The School is running a workshop this weekend. We have a one-day workshop live. We'll be dropping some links in for the workshop. It's a precursor to our world building course, which we do with Narwhal Studios, who are the people behind the Mandalorian, Book of Boba Fett, and all of those wonderful worlds that were created. We do a course in tandem with them. There's a workshop coming up this weekend for that. So come join us for that. And it's been great. I've thoroughly enjoyed today. Pedro, again, thank you.
And thank you.
We'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Take care, everybody.
Cheers.